It's Sal Capaccio.
Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio. Sal Capaccio.
On WGR.
Just asked Bulldog for some friendly fantasy advice, and he just blew me off completely.
You just randomly gave me two games, this versus this, this versus that. Right. No idea what the hell you were talking about, and I
should have been obvious.
Not even real sure I still do, actually.
We're going to take the Raiders.
Okay.
Cool. Raiders defense. It's almost time for me to get to the casino. I can't forget to do that. I can't forget to get to the Seneca Buffalo Creek for those survivor picks. I've got to do that.
You will not forget.
I might forget. I have to get down there and do that every week until I'm out. Sally, any survivor pools this year? I remember being in one with you for a couple of years there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I run one for my, you know, Twitter followers and give away a couple of cool, you know, things. And then I also am in a couple myself, including that. But, yeah, I am. I'm in both a survivor pool and death pool every year. So it is different for sure.
What's the difference?
One, you have to pick the winner. One, you have to pick the winner.
Okay.
The other, you have to pick a loser.
All right, so death pool is then when you have to pick a loser. And you could probably only use a team once, right, in each?
Correct. I think the loser pool or death pool is harder than the survivor pool. Because in a survivor pool, you can pick against the bad teams every week, and generally you're going to get a new team to pick. In a death pool slash loser pool, you can't pick the worst teams every week because you're going to run out of them. And you've already picked them.
Yep. Plus, week one is a little challenging, I would think, for that. You have Jets-Titans.
Yep.
And you have Dolphins Raiders, two games where both teams are coming off really bad seasons. So no gimmies there.
I am probably eyeing the Cardinals Chargers. So I'll go with the Chargers most likely there.
As the winner.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
So today we don't have a practice to talk about, but we've got the depth chart from the Bills. Most interesting thing, would it maybe be Keon Coleman?
No, not for me.
Okay.
I think the most interesting thing for me is having D. Alford listed as the punt returner.
We didn't get to that on the air, but I noticed that when I went to the bottom of the page. I'm like, okay. I mean, obviously they're going to have someone that's on the roster in that spot, right? I mean,
yeah.
And I think I saw you tweeting about this too. Like, there's nothing to stop them from elevating Greg Dortch and having him be their punt returner, but he's not
that's
on
correct.
The active roster, and those elevations won't happen until Saturday 4 p.m., right?
Exactly. And I think what's even more interesting about that is it's not just the Greg Dortch part. It's all of a sudden here comes D. Alford as the punt returner when it was Ray Davis the first 3 weeks of the preseason listed and doing it. And then we really didn't see D. Alford. Did he even have a preseason punt return? I have to go look. I don't think he did, but he might have had one. I know he can do it. And suddenly he kind of came out of nowhere here for this.
Yeah.
Not that he's come out of nowhere as a punt returner. He's done it. I noted that he did it. 20 punt returns, I think, in his career. But this is new. Like, I have kind of been thinking about what's going to happen that first game. And it could very well be Greg Dortch. No doubt about it. But as of right now, you know, just looking at the depth chart, the way it's listed, D. Alford. I'll say this about Keon Coleman. I think a depth chart's a depth chart. They can, you know, kind of put it out however they want. There are three wide receivers listed as starters, and Moore and Coleman on the outside. Coleman over Joshua Palmer. Yeah, I could probably see, you know, that it should have been Palmer in my eyes, and maybe he is the first one on the field before Keon Coleman. But I think a lot of times with wide receivers, they're just a little bit more interchangeable when it comes to this sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah, Alford. 20 returns 3 seasons ago, and that's it. I mean, last year he's listed. He might have had a kickoff return or something. And when Davis muffed the punt against Pittsburgh, I think it was either with a conversation we had with you or we were on in the morning after that, and we're asked, like, is that the kind of – Joe asked you this question. Is that the kind of one play that can really change their minds? Yep. And you said, yeah. Like that.
Yep.
That's that big. Like, that's points against. So – and we did talk about this because I made the point about why do you have anybody do it? But yes, you were right in sort of thinking that they might really punish him for that.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can – I think that if you make a wow return, if you have a wow play, you're not going to necessarily make the team or be the entrenched starter and, oh, my God, we got to keep the guy. But you make a big mistake, that hurts you more than making a big play helps you, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Teams just, they do not want, in a situation like that, you cannot lose the ball. And the biggest thing for me, this was right on the heels of, I had asked Joe Brady at the Cleveland joint practice. I said, what is the most important thing for you? What are you looking for in a punt returner? And he said, get the ball back. That's what he said. If you muff it, then you don't get the ball back. And they just, they want to make sure you don't make a mistake there. That is a, that is the type of play that can cost you a football game. Now, it doesn't have to be an indictment on Ray Davis's career. Lots of great, you know, Hall of Fame players have had a muffed punt, you know, in their life. That happens. But with a guy here that's so inexperienced and he hadn't done it since high school and he really wants the job and he's trying to win the job, he has to do everything right to win that job. So I still wonder if their main punt returner is kind of settled. This is might be an evolving thing throughout the year. Could be D. Alford this week, could be Greg Dortch next week, could be Ray Davis, could be Khalil Shakir. I'm not really sure how they go about this, but I do think that Ray Davis muffing that punt hurt his chances to be that guy.
Well, I'll just say again what I said last week when we talked about this, when they claimed Dortch. I wonder how much of it will come down to maybe it's even opponent-specific, Sal. Do we have something that this guy can do for us on offense against this team? And if we do, if it's a half a dozen snaps or whatever, at least it gives them – I think it validates the decision to use him as your punt returner. I myself – I don't have to be right about this, but I would be surprised if they dressed him only to return punts, and I would say that I'm in favor. I don't want to either just dress him to return punts. I think if he's going to be on the 53 on a game day or active on a game day, I need something besides. I know it's important, but, man, if all I need to do is make sure I catch the ball, just get me somebody else back there. I'm not burning a roster spot on this guy.
Totally understand. And I do think this week, we'll find out more tomorrow, the Khalil Shakir injury, not seeing him at practice for a while here is going to matter. So if we go out there tomorrow and Khalil Shakir is not practicing, I think that that pendulum really starts to swing towards Greg Dortch.
Sure, because his slot is his spot, I think, right? So you've got Skylar Bell there and him, and you might feel you need to have a second guy if Shakir isn't able to go.
And if you go out there and Khalil Shakir is practicing and it feels like, you know, he gets a couple of days in, you still might want to have a little bit more, you know, in case of emergency here, let's make sure we have a guy in the roster. Now, you only get three of these elevations, but other injuries are going to play into this, guys. And right now, they're down to safeties, basically, with practice. Jalen Kilgore and Jordan Hancock. And with the, you know, only three outside boundary corners saying, well, you could always put D. Alford there. Well, one of the thoughts there is Jordan Hancock is very good at making, you know, you could put him in at nickel. So I just think this has to evolve this week. And we'll see where it goes. But these injuries are going to matter about who they elevate.
Right, because Hancock was another guy that was on that list last week, right? He missed some time. So, yeah, I wonder, Sal, the last thing on this, on the punt returner, for me anyways, I wonder if... If they did get to a spot where they really valued Dortch, let's say he gets an opportunity, whether it's Sunday in Houston or not, he impresses as their punt returner. Could he conceivably leapfrog Skylar Bell to be that second slot guy behind Shakir when he's healthy, and Bell maybe doesn't get a jersey on game days?
It's possible. I've maintained I think Skylar Bell dresses, but certainly if they have five healthy wide receivers on the active roster and they want Greg Dortch, it is certainly conceivable that they only dress five and they go and they don't have a sixth. And in that situation, I would think Skylar Bell would probably be the odd man out. He's really not offering you anything on special teams that, you know, Greg Dortch does. And then obviously there are other people around the roster that offer you that. I would say this about Greg Dortch too. Whether or not he's active week one, I would pretty much bet right now he's active week two, because that's against the team that He was not happy about how it went down in Detroit. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. Like, talking with him, he said it blindsided him. That's why he didn't stay there. He went to Buffalo. But I just think against his former team, whether or not he plays Sunday, I think he's playing next Thursday night as of right now.
That's the entirety of his time with Detroit, is like this summer.
Right.
After a few years with Arizona. With Sal Capaccio, you know, you said how, compared to wide receiver, this punt return decision on the depth chart versus wide receiver is more interchangeable. What do you have, if anything, on Coleman over Palmer? Is it insignificant? got to pick somebody. I mean, I don't know. Like, Coleman hasn't been healthy anyway, but he gets his name up top.
The only thing I could probably think of is I think that they would maybe trust Keon Coleman in run situations, a bigger guy, blocking. You know, you can kind of keep him. You have him out there all times. Not that you can't put Joshua Palmer out there in those situations, but Keon Coleman played a lot last year. He was on the field quite a bit. I mean, you go back and look at last year's snap counts. I think if he's in the games, he's healthy. He's pretty much on the field more than any other receiver, essentially. And a lot of that is because they trust him in the run game, especially as the season went on, especially as his rookie year after the season went on. And I think that probably could be a little bit of it, that they just feel like, you know, he's a bigger body. He fits well right there. But, you know, at the end of the day, if we're talking about, you know, who's getting more targets, Joshua Palmer feels like he should right now. Who's on the field more could wind up being Keon Coleman at the end of the day.
All right, Sal, are the captain choices of any significance to you?
No. I always wonder, though, and I don't have this. We can ask tomorrow, maybe. Did the players vote? Generally, it is a player vote, or did Joe Brady just name them? Like, you go to Cleveland, and Todd Monken said they're not even naming team captains. They're going to rotate them all year, right? Like, that's a choice by the organization, the head coach. Everybody does it different. I think Rex Ryan did this, where he didn't have team captains. They rotated every week. You have two on offense, two on defense, two on special teams. The Bills have had in the past, what, I think three captains maybe last year or before. They went all as many as seven or eight at times. It's always different. I'm more interested in, like, the process of arriving at who it is. Having Sam Franklin Jr. as a team captain on special teams, I think, is significant. It means that shows you, again, how important a player like that is to this roster, that he's a guy that they really believe and trust in that phase of the game. No doubt about it. Bradley Chubb as a defensive captain, his first year in the organization, says a lot about what they feel about him and his leadership. No surprise on the offensive side. You know, Josh Allen and Dawson Knox. And, you know, those are the – you're going to make Josh Allen a captain, and Dawson Knox kind of screams that sort of thing. Depth chart-wise, just to real quick go back to that, guys. The only other thing that really kind of I was looking at and waiting on, it did not surprise me. I predicted this. Bernard and Dorian Williams as your linebackers. I that doesn't have to be how they line up. Now, if I'm betting on it, they probably do line up like that. They line up with Terrell Bernard as your middle linebacker, Dorian Williams as your will linebacker. But it doesn't have to be that way. You could get Caleb Ealer-Mazor on the field on the first play. He could be on the first series. I just want to see how this evolves, but that was the other thing I was watching for.
Yeah, I wonder, Sal. I think I mentioned this, that maybe the games, there wasn't a lot of pop from Ealer-Mazor in the games. And I wonder if, I mean, that's just me, you know, reading about the games, watching the games, and trying to draw conclusions, which, again, I mean, good luck. It's preseason. But I wonder if the Bills cooled at all on him. It'll be telling maybe how much or little he plays starting out here early in the year.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Jim Leonard, was it, or Joe Brady? I think it was Jim Leonard who said, you know, they've all earned time, and he did not rule out a possibility of a rotation.
Okay.
I always think that's a bit weird at that spot, right? I mean, your linebackers are on the field. Now, you can say, okay, maybe in certain, like, down and distance, we're going to put Caleb Ealer-Mazor, and it's just a better matchup, maybe a game-to-game matchup, whatever a certain team likes to do. But That's a spot to me you don't really rotate very often at linebacker, especially the middle spot. That's going to be Terrell Bernard. He's calling the defense. I mean, heck, you can only have one guy on the field with the green dot on. He's calling the defense. You know, you come out the field, another guy with the green dot's going to come on, and that all gets a little bit convoluted there. So, but at that spot, Dorian Williams, Caleb Ealer-Mazor, if it is going to be both of them at the will spot, I don't know if I see a rotation, but I wouldn't doubt it if he gets a series here or there. You get the rookie's feet wet. You want to see what he can do. There was an answer during a press conference recently, too, about asking Leonard or Brady, one of them, about Caleb Ealer-Mazor, and they mentioned something like he had a really good spring. They didn't say, like, yeah, he's been great this preseason, right? So that could very well be it. You know, you're like, maybe, hey, we really like him, but we haven't seen the elevation of what we wanted to over the three preseason games.
Yeah, it's interesting to center that comment, that compliment on spring, because we're long past spring. We're almost to fall. Here, I got one other thing at least on the depth chart, and it was I think we led the show talking about it today, and that's Dalton Kincaid in the number one slot at tight end. I don't think that's been the case other years, has it? I don't think I've ever noticed that.
I'd have to go back and look at depth charts. I don't think anybody is questioning who the number one tight end is on this team. It's Dalton Kincaid. But they do run so much 12 and even 13 right. that we're going to see a lot of all these tight ends on the field. So I went back and looked last year. The Buffalo Bills played the Houston Texans last year, and the starting offense for the game, let me just make sure I have this right again. I brought it up a little while ago. I was going to bring this up to myself again. Here we go. Starting offense, who does the very first snap, two tight ends, Dawson Knox and Jackson Hawes were on the field. Not Dalton Kincaid. He missed the game. Right. But the Bills did start the game out in 12, and it was Knox and Hawes in that game.
Right.
They also had two tight ends on the field when they started in Houston 2 years ago with Knox and Kincaid. I fully expect it. Bulldogs, as we talked about it earlier, because I'm ready to bet a lot of money that that Knox is on the field for the first play. Like, I think that, you know, against that team on the road, you know, but we'll see. Sal, so here we are. I mean, it's Texans time. Last week was, what did Joe Brady say? Buffalo versus Buffalo or something
still
like that?
Right.
Yes.
But that's dead. I mean, it's here we go. Houston, and for all the times we have talked about this game, you know, when the schedule came out, and we know the history, it's not pretty for the Bills in that stadium in recent years. You know, how do you feel about the matchup as we get close to it?
It's a tough matchup for the Bills. As I get closer to it, I feel a little bit better from a Bills perspective for this one very reason, that the Bills are so much different on defense. And they can probably do a lot of things that maybe the Texans aren't quite ready for or prepared for. And even D'Amico Ryans said that. D'Amico Ryans said something like, you know, new defense. We really don't know what we're going to see. And I think the Bills can try to lean into that a little bit, use that to their advantage. Maybe just come up with some things that, you know, Houston come back and look. And even, it's not just a new defense, right? But it's also a new defensive coordinator who's never been a defensive coordinator in the NFL. Mm-hmm. You can't go back 5 years and see what he did somewhere, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, we know what to expect from a Jim Leonard defense. You could say, yeah, he coached under Vance Joseph. He played under, coached under Rex Ryan. You could do all that. You can go to his college days at Wisconsin if you want to do that. But I remember many times talking with Bills coaches about this very thing. They'd be like, yeah, but, you know, we know what he did back in when he coached in L.A., you know, 6 years ago or something, and we can take some stuff from that. That's not the case here. So I think from that perspective, I like it. It was interesting. We talked with Mark Vandermeer, the Texans play-by-play guy, on Always Game Day in Buffalo the other day, and he said, he goes, you know, not from a Texans team standpoint, of course, he said, but it's almost like because the way that things have gone the last 2 years, he said, I'm not going to say like Texans fans are looking past the Bills, but it feels like they just feel like, oh, yeah, it's the Bills. We handle them. We handle Josh Allen. So I'm intrigued from that standpoint there.
Yeah, I'm really, really interested to see how soon they, if they need to. I mean, I would respect, you know, new year, our guys are healthy. You know, Spencer Brown was not healthy in that game, and it really showed. Dawkins had a tough time, too. They really left them on islands almost all night, despite how badly it was going. I'm all for trying that again to start the game, just to see, like, can our guys, like, rise to the challenge, so to speak. But, boy, they better have a quick pivot in their back pocket, because to my eyes, they really did not last year, and it's still one of the most confounding things I've ever seen them do. Because it was clear that it was hurting them, and they just didn't seem to have a fallback, and like, wow, well, let's just hope this rep goes better. Nope. Okay, let's try it again. What are we doing? So they better, I'd be stunned, even more stunned than I was last year, if there isn't something that they're ready to leave a guy in to chip or whatever it takes.
That's right. And during that game, of course, what happened, Josh Allen was, you know, just beaten up, sacked a lot. You can't have that happen this time. You just can't put your quarterback in that position this time. You have to do something a little bit different. Not only do they have Daniil Hunter and they have Willie Anderson, they now have added Jadeveon Clowney, and, you know, talking to Mark Vandermeer again, like he said, like he's going to be a part of the rotation, and, you know, he's going to be a guy they're going to bring on in certain situations. He's going to help them out. This is a fast defense, no doubt about it. I'll tell you this, guys. I think tomorrow we're going to get a little glimpse at this on who's practicing, who's not. We talk about Khalil Shakir. I think Khalil Shakir is very important to this game. But I think Ty Johnson might be even more important because of everything you're talking about. Bulldog, this is a third down back the Bills really trust. He's a very good pass protector. But also, getting the ball out of Josh Allen's hands, giving him an opportunity to throw the ball to get to one of the running backs out of the backfield. These guys are coming. You're coming off the edge. Bam, there's my guy. I'll just dump it off to him. Let him kind of do his work. So I think Ty Johnson is a really important player here, and if he's going to be available to play for the Bills or not, and that's going to start tomorrow and looking at that injury report.
Reportedly, Baker Mayfield and the Bucs have a deal. That was one Mayfield had stopped negotiating with Tampa Bay, and he would be up after this year, but reportedly a three-year extension for Mayfield at up to $165 million. You know, seems like about the going rate.
Yes. Right.
Do you have a thought on how the 49ers and Rams are approaching Australia so differently?
Yes, my thought is there is no one right way. We can dissect it all we want. These teams can say they have all of their sports scientists on top of it. Go back and look. Some teams have gone to, and I know Australia is different. I get it. It's much further away. Some teams have gone to London or Germany early and won, and some have gone early and lost. Some have gone late and won. Some have gone late and lost. And I know the Bills received a lot of grief for how they, you know, went to London a few years ago. I mean, they also, during that game, lost some really key players early in the game. Maybe it mattered. I do think they started the game slow, and I think Jacksonville was there. But guess what? Jacksonville's, you know, they've gone there late and won. I think the Rams did that. So I think it's just really what your preference is for your team. And then you kind of Monday morning quarterback it, to be honest with you, and say, oh, I guess we'll do that differently next time. And right. We did this the right way. That's just how it works.
The game I think about is when Rex Ryan was the Bills coach and the Bills went to Seattle, like you might have been on that trip, the day before the Monday night game in Seattle.
Yep.
And that was one where they just, you know, did not acclimate. Seattle's almost as far as London would be for, you know, the Bills in terms of travel, a little shorter, but still. And that was how Rex did it. We were talking about this then, you know, 10, 11 years ago, just what the right answer is.
I mean, in that same year, I think that was the year that the Bills flew out to L.A., played at the Coliseum. Nicole Roby Coleman has a pick six, and the Bills trounced them. And I think, if I remember right, being on the charter, went out 2 days before that. And L.A. wasn't as good. But again, here's an example of it just – it's football, right? I mean,
yeah.
And the Bills, by the way, played a good game that night in Seattle and almost won the game right at the end of the game.
Yep.
Remember if all that happened. But you're right. I mean, it's something that's always going to be talked about and debated.
Yeah, 2016, I believe, was that game in Seattle. So 10
that's,
years.
That's Richard Sherman assaulting. Yes. Who's the depth receiver at the goal line? I forget the name now. It's not a super familiar guy, but he was playing in that spot, and Sherman just took all kinds of liberties with him.
Yeah,
it wasn't Andre Roberts, but it was someone.
Walt
Powell.
Thank you, Walt Powell. Yeah, good one.
I had to look it up, but yeah, and it just was incredible that wasn't a penalty. But you know, we had our thing, we did our dance about whether that would be interference. Is the quarterback in the pocket? Is he throwing the ball yet? I'm like, you can't just murder somebody out there, no matter what. And Sherman clapped back about it because he got defensive about people thinking it should have been a penalty. He's like, basically, he was like, know the rules.
You don't know the
like,
rules.
You can't just destroy a player, you know, defenseless receiver. You see that called for way less than what that play was, you know, but it was the end of the game and Seattle was.
He also hit a defenseless kicker in Dan Carpenter that night, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
Right before halftime.
There was a lot of nasty in that game. Mm-hmm. That team had that rep, though. That's the Legion of Boom. That they were hard hitting, nasty.
I dare you to throw the flag.
Right. Commit fouls until they, you know,
they did.
Just get tired of throwing flags and then you get away with it.
That's a lot to be said for that. All right, Sal, thank you. We'll talk again tomorrow.
All right, you got it, guys. Thanks.
That's our Sal Capaccio on the Western Hotline. His appearances are brought to you by New York's only outlet liquor. When you need to stock up, it's the place to buy a case. What's your outlet?
Still want to spend a few minutes on Michigan, Western Michigan. Interesting that the MAC is now appealing the outcome of the game. And I saw Sneaky Joe tweet the other night after that happened. This is one where you could do that because the game was over. There's nothing else. I was thinking about like how they've paid out all the bets. But I don't know. Is there any chance? We'll talk about it. 803-0550, Mike Schopen and the Bulldog, WGR.
After review, there's 1 second remaining in the game. Third down.
You know, our inset clock is showing it at zero. Apparently, their system is showing it at one.
On third down, Deep drop. Going to unload it towards the end zone. Into the crowd. And it's caught. J.J. Buchanan. Touchdown. A miracle at Michigan Stadium.
Yes. I don't even really know where to start. I mean, I hate this so much. It has always made me crazy. Because now, I don't know, like, this is my opinion. Often with these kind of controversies, like the Tuck rule was like this, where we end up arguing about the wrong things, not the common sense things. We end up arguing about, you know, what was the Tuck rule? Well, he pump faked earlier on the play, and then he fumbled, but that's technically not a fumble, which of course it is. And we still have yet to see quarterbacks pump fake every single snap to take advantage of that, because then they would never get charged with a fumble, but we don't have that. Like, we end up arguing about the wrong things and not the common sense. And there is still a debate, and apparently there are people who defend the officials in that game. You know, even Terry McCauley, who's pretty contrarian, if that's the word, when it comes to these kind of rulings for a TV ref, he's often like very kind of calmly be like, yeah, that's wrong. You know, he gives you a lot of that, but that's not really the point. He was like, yeah, well, there must be two different. And I guess you would know that if you were him, you would know that if you were an official in this game, that apparently there's a stadium clock and then there's this like TV clock or whatever it is. I don't want to argue about that. All I know is with basketball and now football and even hockey, we have moved as a society to a place where only really at the end of games we are going to parse the more stoppages, right? More time to stop and look at it, and everybody just sits there for like tenths of seconds. And it's absurd. Because it never happens until the end, as if time is a different construct at the end of games.
All the other fractions of seconds or entire seconds that get wasted in, you know, all game long are irrelevant, but now they matter. And yeah, that's especially in the basketball example is because I think if you don't pay attention all year a lot, and then the tournament comes, you're sort of reminded, oh yeah, they do this. They do this thing. Yeah. Wow. It's just ever annoying.
Why shouldn't there ever be a consideration that it takes a human being some measure of time to hit stop on the clock? Like, it isn't automatic. When the ball hits the ground or when the ball goes out of bounds in basketball, is not when the clock stops. It's when the person who's keeping the clock reacts to it. And it's close, but it's not exactly on the spot.
And like, if they can't stop it before it gets to all zeros, then the game should be over.
Easily.
It's not that hard.
Okay. I mean, sorry, but we're done here. That's zero means zero is zero.
Right.
And the difference there to me just makes me angry even. Like, I just, I can't believe. I keep saying that and I stop myself. I can't believe it happened. Of course I can believe it happened.
I think it's okay to say you can't believe it happened. Like, this example to me is more egregious than I think almost anything we've ever seen. And it's not just because Western Michigan is, well, Western Michigan. Like, they're the, you know, it's like, you know, it's like when Michigan lost to Appalachian State or however many years ago that was. Like, it's a massive, not as massive as it would have been. I mean, Michigan was in the top 25 at number 16 or something going into the game.
They were four touchdown favorite.
Right. Okay. Fine. So, huge favorite. And, you know, Western Michigan is one of these, you know, it's a little MAC school. And they're playing the big, bad Big Ten team and all that. And so, but even put all that aside, like anything like this happens, it is unbelievable to me that they took that win down. Like the kids are on the field. It's all, you know, if the game were in Western Michigan, the fans would have been on the field for crying out loud. And I wonder how much that impacts the decision making, because no one floods the field. The game is at the Big House in Michigan. Everyone's stunned. Oh, we lost to Western Michigan. Nobody's running on the field. They can get the teams off the field and restore order relatively quickly.
Yeah, now we're talking about like Brett Hull.
Yeah, right. Where it's just like the bell has rung, everybody. We've got 5,000 people on the field, or whatever number you want here, but some number of fans, and maybe just go, well, you know what? Yeah, the replay, forget it. We're out. We got to go. We're not going to try to unring this bell. It's unringable, or it can't be unrung. So I do think it is. It's unbelievable, I think, Fitz, because it still is stunning to me. I don't know what is going to happen now. I would assume nothing.
Me too.
But now, you know, Western Michigan, or really the MAC, after rolling over, well, I don't know if that was Saturday night or Sunday morning. I saw it Sunday morning. I fell asleep and didn't know like what the responses to all this were. But, you know, Sunday morning, it all looked like, yeah, okay, you know, they got it right. We have to live with it, you know, go Broncos in the future kind of vibe. And now today, it's, I don't know what changed, like who got involved or pushed it, but now they're, yeah, they want the result reversed, and I just can't fathom a scenario where that happens.
Plus, there's the whistle. I mean, the clock operator is reacting to the whistle in sports, not to where they think the ball went out of bounds or whatever.
Or who touched it, right. Because the thing here is the guy that touched it, I think, leapt from out of bounds so that when he touched the ball.
That was the end of the play?
That's the end of the play. Because it was an illegal touch, I guess.
Yeah, see, you can, in these, you can often kind of talk yourself into it. Like, okay, sure, illegal touch. But
well, I used the wrong phrasing there. Because if it was an illegal touch, there would have been a penalty. And that's a whole different thing. Then there's an untimed down element probably. But I just know from watching it that they said the kid that touched it was out of bounds. Therefore, the clock should stop right away.
There still, though, as you know, is time needed for the official to blow the whistle and then the clock operator to respond to that. And we only just willfully ignore that when it's like this. And I just don't understand it. Like why does nobody ever even say that? When you're basketball is the worst. Like when you're watching a basketball game and they stop the games, like there aren't enough stoppages in the last 3 minutes of a close basketball game. There's only 10 timeouts already. You just sit there and wait and wait and wait. Now we got to go to the table and see if we can't put 3/10 back on the clock. It's all the replay culture to blame. I mean, that's just, we continue to think, we collectively, I don't, you don't, we continue to think that this is all good. This is helpful. Oh, they deserve that 1 second. They put a second on the clock, by the way, on the play before. I was watching this game. They did the same thing from 8 seconds to 9. And I don't know how these clocks always work, but when you stop a clock like this at 8 seconds, it's 8 point something that's left. And I don't know, when you reset it to 9, is that 9.99 or is that 9.0? Is it only do you ever hear anybody make that point?
It's
all just unnecessary.
I did not know this about the 8 to 9 seconds.
Yeah, because there has to be some amount of time in there.
Yes. I think it is now this sort of thing, and then this game will, I think, maybe add to this for people who also, like us, are like-minded and hate replay. I think this is the most egregious. The clock review, I think, is the most egregious application of replay. Like if you want to tell me you got replay because you want to avoid egregious mistakes, right? Any wrongs that are obvious, clear and obvious. Use the lingo, however you want to use the lingo, right? We don't want an unjust outcome. The clock has been the clock since clocks were clocks. Like there's nothing new there. There's no, like, someone's hand to press the button or whatever, a big red easy button like Office Depot. However they stop it, they've been stopping it for all this time. Nothing has changed about that transaction, but now we're going to go pour over it. And now we're going to find out that actually game control has a slightly different clock than the clock that you're watching on the broadcast or even the clock that the players and the coaches are watching in the stadium. It's just...
Was there a holding penalty in the third quarter that went uncalled?
Right.
Were there 30? What are we going to do about, what's the difference?
I got to stop short of saying it's evil, because I mean, it's evil. It is not necessary. Nothing has changed about that that needed to be addressed by using replay. It's not bigger, stronger, faster athletes on a smaller field or anything else that has caused it to be necessary for leagues at all, you know, all leagues, any sport you want, to feel like they need this help, right? The clock is, it's there. It's constant. Nothing has ever changed about it. And suddenly now we're going to review that. Well, you know, it turns out there was a lag. Oh my gosh. There's always been a lag, you idiots. For 100 years, there's been a lag. And now we're going to start micro-analyzing it, and it's just...
Well, sometimes the difference is maybe not here, but how many cameras are in use at a stadium at a game versus when Western Michigan goes to play UB, they're not going to have that kind of sophistication on the broadcast for being able to see every play from every angle. That's not necessarily a clock issue, but somebody's foot came down out of bounds, and we can't change that in that game because there's only three cameras. But in this game, there's 30.
Tuesday night action, like, yeah, whatever. Yep.
Every time you break down these things, it's just, well, they break down easily. I mean, just there's so many incongruous aspects to it, and it would just be so much better if they didn't bother. And I know that you're going to say, someone's going to say, well, this was fair. Says who? What about the 100 other things in this game that could have been called differently that might have cost 1 second even? Like, I don't know. You might feel the same way. It gets frustrating to just try to rephrase this all the time based on what the last example was, where it's not that complicated. It's just, why would the end of the game, what would seconds count differently? Well, I don't know. Somebody throws the ball away in a game. When does the clock stop? Is the clock operator supposed to stop the clock when the ball crosses the sideline? He or she wouldn't even have like a fair view of that from a press box. And then the official, I actually don't know the answer to this question. Does the official wait for the ball to land?
Before signaling incomplete?
Is that when it becomes incomplete?
Or is the side judge over there watching when the ball crosses the sideline, and then does he signal incomplete, and that's when the clock operator hits? Yeah, I don't know. Good question. Don't know.
But you don't really need to know because
no, you shouldn't,
the game isn't
you shouldn't need to know, but now they're trying to make us need to know. I don't need to know everything. I definitely don't need to know this. I mean, I like to have as much information as I can if it's, you know, useful.
This just makes you mad.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think...
The biggest shock is that I was watching Western Michigan on Saturday night.
Well, yeah, it was hard not to want to get there because I was watching, what the hell was I watching? I was watching another
Notre
game.
Notre Dame?
I don't remember. No.
No, that was the next night.
I can't remember what I was watching. Okay. I watched that earlier, then ended at 7:45. Whatever. I had college football on, and Twitter tells me this is happening. Like, oh, yeah, you better get to that. I want to get to that. I got to see that.
Yeah.
And
that's what I did.
Yeah. So I bet a lot of people did. I wonder if the roles had been reversed and Western Michigan, like, do they get it's the Big Ten officiating mechanism here.
Never would they get one more play.
Right. No. And
there's your fans on the field point.
Right. But if they had, and everything else is the same except the roles are reversed. Are we mad because the little underdog school that could got the extra time and they beat the behemoth? I wonder how we feel about that.
I'd have to say that I would probably feel differently, but it doesn't really change the fundamental point.
Yep.
Mike Schopen, the Bulldog. This is WGR.